listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates. In today's episode, we get to share another crossover with the Lutheran Witness. Today's episode of The Coffee Hour is underwritten in part by Concordia University, Wisconsin. You can learn more about Concordia University, Wisconsin by visiting cuw.edu. The Reverend Roy Askins and I sit down with the Secretary of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in today's episode, and we get to learn more about the nominations process for the LCMS leading up to Synod Convention in 2026. Today, we pick up where we left off last time. In this conversation, Dr. Sias shares more of a brief history of the boards and committees of Synod and the why of boards and committees of Synod.
So yeah, there are those resources out there. Board of Directors is pretty demanding. The colleges and universities and seminaries, I think those boards also are very active. They have quite a scope of responsibility. I mean, you think about running a university, especially, which is beholden not only to the Synod, which kind of founded it and holds it as its own, and it exists to serve the purposes of the Synod, the mission of the church, but also responsible to all its students and faculty, a broader community with a whole lot of needs, a lot of regulation from the federal government and from others, creditors, some pretty demanding financial situations often. That's a lot for a region to shoulder, and God bless the folks that take that on. Mm-hmm. But it is a commitment, but I'll say also generally kind of a fun one. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are definitely times that are hard, mm-hmm. but the ability to be part of a team that is making a difference for the church and trying to see that the institutions the church has built over the years are regulated to serve the gospel in the day-to-day, and regulated in such a way that they're going to continue to serve future generations, it can be an exciting thing to be part of.
I can imagine. I did a little bit of work with a very small board in Hong Kong. It was a nonprofit that we'd set up, and it was really neat to kind of see how everything was operating and run and
right.
and kind of help guide that in a godly way. It was very exciting.
Yeah. For sure.
We've moved on to talk a little bit about regents for the CUS. You mentioned they're hard to find. Do you have any reasons why? Like, is there anything popping out in terms of why they might be particularly difficult in terms of finding them instead of, say, like, the board director for Synod or something?
Right, right. I mean, one of the reasons is that the Synod, and I think wisely, quite a number of years ago, established some particular requirements to be a university regent. Interestingly, we did not apply them to the seminary regents. Hmm. Maybe because we think the seminaries are operationally a little less complicated. Hmm. But it's just one of these interesting conundrums of, the making of laws. There is no end. They don't have to make sense. They're just the law. but there are specific requirements. You have to have a certain number of a certain list of aptitudes, which include things like, financial aptitude or a legal skill or human resources knowledge. Higher education governance experience. Because of those boards are answerable not only to the Synod, but also to accreditors and to regulators, mm-hmm. they really need to be the caliber of folks that can govern a university that won't just, we're not looking just for cheerleaders. We're not looking just for donors. Mm-hmm. We're not looking just for people to keep the required 12 or however many seats around the table full while we do what we're going to do anyway. We're looking for folks that can critically engage even with a very skilled and very capable executive, a president of an institution and a faculty, and actively work at making them better, challenging them mm-hmm. to improve the institution even in difficult circumstances. And so that takes a special caliber of person. And so the committee, I think, is careful, to try to screen those candidates. They're also screened by the CUS now. It used to be a screening that I and the president of the CUS would perform. Now the CUS Board of Directors is going to be responsible for screening those regent nominees. But that's one, one reason. I think it's also kind of a daunting thing for a lot of people to think of, serving as a regent, being responsible mm-hmm. for governing, mm-hmm. Which is not something we have a lot of native experience with. We're much more comfortable being governed, much more used to it anyway, than actually stepping into that governing role, which is tricky. It's stepping outside of yourself in a certain way.
Does that stepping into this role of governing an institution like this bear with it additional burdens beyond simply the idea that I have to do this work now.
Yeah.
But are there other fiduciary responsibilities, anything else like this that devolves onto the, or kind of rests on the regents when they do this?
Absolutely. For those that are members of boards or officers of corporations, you know, there's a legal or ethical concept of fiduciary duty. Mm-hmm. And the fiduciary is someone who guards the foetus, the trust, the deposit for someone else. So you're not there as you and for your own purposes and to make the seminary crank out guys that are just like you were, or worse. you're there to see that the seminary, the college, university, the publishing house, whatever, is serving the needs of the whole synod. These things are synod institutions. And so you are the trustee, if you want to use that term, of a sacred trust, you know, a legal trust and a sacred trust, mm-hmm. Which even in a legal sense implies the duties of care, of loyalty, and of obedience. Those are the classical fiduciary duties, you know, that you're legally responsible for carrying out. The duty of care, that you're there exercising the level of care that an ordinary prudent person would. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're given financials, you're evaluating those financials and not just trusting that the executive says all's well, but you're looking at the audits, you're looking at the quarterlies, you're asking questions about stuff that doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. And if you're not, you're not doing the job of a director, a regent. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's incredibly important. All our folks are doing as directors, and we all have those skills to one level or another, or in different areas. You know, not everybody has to be a financial whiz kid on that board, but you need enough of them that you know when you're not asking the right questions. Mm-hmm. So the board members can support each other in that respect. The duty of loyalty, that your loyalty is to the institution you serve, to the college, university, seminary, the synod that's behind and in and through it. It's kind of this perichoresis of the synod mm-hmm. through everything. And not to your own purposes. You're not cutting the carpet cleaning contract to your cousin, mm-hmm. you know, just to enrich him at the expense of the university. You know, you're not looking out for various special interests, but you're trying to promote the good of the whole. And then the duty of obedience, which is sometimes, even though we're used to being governed more than governing, obedience doesn't come naturally. to learn and understand what's the role I've been given and to carry that out without getting into somebody else's stuff, you know, to say, well, the bylaws of the synod, the bylaws of my organization, the laws of my state tell me this is my job, and I'm gonna do that even when it's hard. So those things, if you're a thinking person, if you engage with the task, there's a burden there that goes beyond the hours of reading or sitting in meetings to you're shouldering an actual duty. Mm-hmm. Which is not oppressive, and somebody's got to do it, and it's good. I mean, we can go into it with the zeal of a young Marine, right, and take the beachhead, and it's great. But it's not nothing.
So, I mean, could we describe part of the responsibility of a trustee or a director or a regent as knowing, once again, the constitution, bylaws of the organization, knowing the rules of the government, and then comparing the actions of the institution over against these things to ensure that they're continuing to remain in accord with these?
Right. Yeah. The kind of regulative function of a governing body is really important. And some of our boards, like our boards of regents, are explicitly charged with making sure that their documents and policies are in order with what the Synod has established the thing to do. You know, so mm-hmm. that's huge. You know, but yes, that is a big piece of governance. It's not all of governance, though, because governance is not just kind of a passive audit function, mm-hmm. Or a kind of a passive monitoring function, but also a guiding function that's asking the right questions, that's prompting the right studies and developments to try to move the institution forward in the mission that it's been given. Mm-hmm. And maybe the obedience comes in there in the mission that it's been given too, that, you know, if I've got a university, a publishing house or whatever, I'm not out to make it successful some other way, mm-hmm. but to make it actually fulfill the church's purposes and bear fruit, you know, for our congregations, through our congregations, through what it's doing. But yeah, those two pieces, kind of the regulative piece, important, but then the really you know, governing as in keeping the train moving forward, mm-hmm. keeping the boiler hot, you know, is also there too.
Would you say it's fair maybe to compare somewhat to school accreditation? In school accreditation, we go through this process
right.
to make sure that we are, as a school, who we say we are and doing what we say we do.
Right.
So there's some accountability in that sense. So many of these boards and committees are serving that form of accountability, not necessarily just to be mean watchdogs, but to
right.
so that we can be held accountable to ourselves for being who we say we are and doing what we say we do.
Yeah, there's some really nice analogies with that process. You know, and one of those is that the accreditors are not there to run your school. They're to help you see how to run your school better,
mm-hmm.
right? If they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. and a board is something like that. A board, you know, that tries to get down into the weeds of managing everything and, you know, really doing the job of an executive or a director or even the staff below, its head is down. It's not able to really govern the institution. If you manage everything, you can govern nothing. And so that's a really key aspect of a board keeping its head up in governance, knowing what it has to monitor to see that folks are accountable to the tasks that the board has put them there for, but also giving them the tools and then stepping back and saying, okay, now go and execute on this. And we'll have questions for you, you know, without trying to just do it all itself, because there's nothing crazier than, you know, 8-12 people trying to be the executive collectively, you know, for an organization.
Executive calves, by committee.
12-headed calves don't live too long.
So suppose we have a nominee we think has, you know, say financial skills and it could really be a benefit
right.
to a board, but they've never served on a committee before or anything like this, a board. Is there training available? Like, does the Synod, when this person comes into the board, do they receive training in terms of how they're supposed to be doing this or not? Or how does that work
right.
out?
Yeah, so it depends a little bit. The scope of that training depends a little bit on the particular position. But mm-hmm. All the folks that are newly elected to a position with the Synod, there's kind of a general orientation that the president's office holds after the convention at about the time of the installation in September, where folks are invited to come in and visit not only with us, but with one another. Kind of get to know their class of incoming people and to begin to be introduced to the challenges in broad strokes. For our colleges and universities, the regents have specific training, part of which is offered by the board of directors and has to do with fulfilling bylaw functions, and CUS helps out with that as well. Part of that is done by the board of regents and has to do with kind of general board skills, and then the particular financial and operational realities of governing university. So there are those kind of on-ramp opportunities. There are also good opportunities out in the district. So we're talking about Synod-elected offices. Every district has a board of directors that deals on a smaller scale, but nonetheless a significant one, with some of the same kind of questions that we see at the Synod level. There are also other opportunities, you know, at the district level or in other places to gain some experience. But I'd say those, you know, district venues, and then just kind of having a look at, you know, requesting minutes, reading the reports that are in the convention workbook when that comes out from each of the agencies, and getting an idea of what's going on, what are kind of the things that are on the radar the boards and commissions are needing to deal with.
You're listening to the Lutheran Witness Podcast on the Coffee Hour. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Andy Bates.
At Concordia University, Wisconsin, we believe you were created for a reason. To use your God-given gifts to help others. To live a life of self-sacrifice in a me-first world. To live a life that's uncommon. Whether you're taking one of 50-plus online programs or learning with us in person on the shores of Lake Michigan, you'll be equipped to make an uncommon impact. Learn more at cuw.edu. Concordia University, Wisconsin. Live uncommon.
Welcome back to the Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates. Today we are continuing a crossover episode of the Lutheran Witness here on the Coffee Hour. The Reverend Roy Askins and I had the opportunity to talk with the Reverend Dr. John Sias, Secretary of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, about the great need for nominations for several boards and committees for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
I kind of want to move to a little bit more of the why now. Why boards and commissions and kind of the historical framework for how we got to this point where we have all of these boards and commissions that need people to fill them. You can imagine somebody in the pew listening to this podcast saying, you know, St. Paul didn't have a board of directors to direct his work. Why do we have this now? Like, why are we at this point? Why do we have these type of structures? I realize it's a huge question.
Yeah.
It's a podcast. So we can go as long as we need to.
Right? Yeah, there you go. There you go. You're bringing snacks at a certain point. It is something that runs back to the beginning of the synod, the having of these things. And it's sort of interesting that the boards in many cases preceded the board. So the board of directors, there kind of really wasn't one at the very beginning of the synod.
Okay.
But we had a bunch of boards that were charged with doing specific things, specific missions, specific functions, mm-hmm. some of which have now passed from necessity. There was a railroad secretary and a board of transportation or something like this that dealt with schlepping people around to conventions on, trying to get railroad tickets and line up railroad tickets for the circuit preachers that we had running out to places like Montana when there weren't congregations out there.
Wow.
And so some of these things have passed to glory. But in the history of the Synod, there were many, many more boards in the past than there are today.
I believe so. Wasn't it in 1965 where they merged? I want to say there was like 10 different boards that got merged into one board for foreign missions or something like
that. Yeah, there was an enormous period of growth from about the 20s until about the 60s. And then some kind of reality started to set in that every man, woman, and child in the Synod, can't be pressed into service on three committees. So they trim back a little bit. And even more recently, before 2010, which now I know is ancient history. But before 2010, there were more boards than we have now. Now we have board of directors, we have national mission, we have international mission. But there were things like the board for communication services, mm-hmm. And the board for congregation and district services, and board for mission services. There were boards that had somewhat more specific purposes and that really had more sway within their pieces of the budget and domains of operations than we have now. We've kind of come trimmed down. But I think that trimming makes it all the more important that the folks that we have on the boards that have continued to exist bring the knowledge and insight and I would say conversational outreach into the whole synod that we need to be able to make good decisions at this level.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about the Board for National Mission, you've got two members, essentially. There's some other advisories and so on, but two voting members from each region of the synod. So it's 10 folks. You think of the number of functions that are grouped under that board. And, think of trying to make, discipleship resources, outreach resources, stewardship resources that really reach and supply the needs of the whole scope of congregations that we have in the synod,
mm-hmm.
from congregations of 20 members up to congregations of thousands of members, geographical areas that have really quite different ways of life, ways of getting around, ways of people relating to one another.
Mm-hmm.
In your evangelism stuff, it's going to make a difference if you drive past more people than cows, getting to church. If you're, if you're in the New England district and the Montana district have about the same number of congregations, same number of people in them, but their reach to people in their communities is extraordinary. I couldn't even reach that many cows before I was in Montana. So, trying to cover the bases and have a synod that's able to serve the whole synod,
mm-hmm.
it takes the ingenuity, the cooperation, the interplay, the fruitful discussion of more than just, one executive that you've brought in to run the thing.
Yeah. You've mentioned the board. Board of Directors and the Board for National Mission, Board for International Mission. Can you briefly articulate how they relate to each other, how those three boards kind of function, interact? And then we'll kind of dig into, say, like Board for National Mission and the various functions that roll up under it and why you want this kind of broad range of expertise.
Right.
There.
Yeah. What's sort of interesting, you know, since 2010 is that the boards are of different kinds. The Synod Board of Directors is a governing board. It deals with property, legal, business matters, for all of corporate synod and to some extent for all of synod. The two mission boards are mission boards, which are defined differently. They don't actually direct all that much. Their members are not really directors, but they do monitor the function of the offices of National International Mission. They can develop certain policies that govern how those offices function. And in that they have some, you know, directive freight, some governing authority. I will say both boards are still kind of figuring out what that role means. Mm-hmm. And here we are in 2025. We put this in place in 2010. You know, it's taken some time to kind of figure out relative to, you know, the executives and relative to the budgetary control of the board of directors. What are these boards really doing? It's not the same as in the old days when those boards were governing boards themselves. So they're kind of more policy and monitoring boards than the board of directors is. They do have some specific functions, especially on the Board for International Missions side, where they are governing, sending, releasing missionaries. They're kind of making actual operational decisions at the recommendation of the Office of International Mission. But they have some of those additional functions that have just been assigned to them as the board that manages the missionary population of the Synod.
Mm-hmm.
A distinction of roles. The mission boards certainly are much more on the mission side, engaged in questions about, you know, how do we carry out the church's mission? What's the content of our materials? What's our approach and outreach? Whereas the board of directors, I won't say, you know, it's kind of the cold, you know, hard facts. There is a lot that they do that deeply impacts the mission of the synod. But it's limited to that more mechanical, abstracted sense from how are we going to carry out the church's mission.
So this is why, you know, when you're looking for nominees for the BIM and BNM in particular, you're looking for a wide range of experiences.
Yes.
Because once again, you're looking for somebody who can represent the fields of Montana as well as, you know, the streets of the Atlantic District.
Right. And we have the regional representation, you know, so at least the five regions of the Synod are represented on those two. But the ability to not only to bring one's personal experiences, but to understand the experience and perspective of others and to be able to integrate those into a way that moves the thing forward together.
So as you, over the years, have you seen nominations generally increasing or decreasing?
They ebb and flow a little bit. On the presidential side, it ebbs and flows much more violently, kind of depending on how enthused people are about a presidential election one way or another. It seems easier for people to focus on who's the big guy, you know, but the big guy doesn't do everything.
Yeah.
And these nominations, you know, we were in a pretty steady decline until last time. Last time we saw a little bit of an increase, which we were grateful for. This time we've got the new electronic system, but seems we're kind of fighting the downward trend again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that threat of disengagement, it really does threaten our life together as a synod. And this is one of the areas where I think it threatens us the most, not getting the pile of names that we should for that committee to be... Hey, maybe forced to go through to, in a sense, free them from their preconceptions too, and look at a wide range of candidates that have a wide range of skill sets and abilities, and you know, shake their preconceptions about who do I want to put on this board.
Mm-hmm.
With we've got an embarrassment of riches here. What's the best we can do for the Senate?
Make it concrete when you say it really threatens our life together. You know, how do you see that really being threatened by this lack of nominations, the lack of people bringing forth these names? Why is that dangerous?
Yeah, well, I mean, how do you feel about Social Security?
Not so great.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe we'll have to put this in the director's cut. You know, it's one of those things that's there. none of us is too enthused about it till we get a check.
Mm-hmm.
And when we get the check, all we care about is the check keeps coming.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what the thing does, you know, as long as it's doing the thing I want. And you know, that's not the way to engage with your church.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something, you know, historically that's made Social Security work all that well in this country, the forgotten thing that we feed every once in a while and mm-hmm. cry about when it isn't doing what we want. We don't want the church to become that. And the Synod really is, you know, the whole thing is a completely voluntary organization. And I don't know if the folks think about all that much, but there's nothing that keeps a congregation in the Synod. I mean, we won't come take your property if you decide to leave. We're not gonna be able to boot your pastor and put someone else in there, send someone down from St. Louis, you know, if your guy's not doing what we think he should. He's your pastor, you know, and we can't tax you. That's been true since the very beginning. C.F.W. Walther had a dim view of taxes. And although there was a tax on church workers, they had to subscribe to the, you know, to the Lutheran witness sort of thing. So we might want to bring that back.
You know? I'm okay with that.
Save that for the director's cut. There was that, so they had to pay for the publications and a district convention stuff and a bunch of things. But that aside, it was like $1, mm-hmm. right? Which was probably a lot.
That's then. A lot, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, it was probably a chunk of a book, too. They were a little more prolix at that time. Anyway, that we've never taxed our congregations. You know, congregations give to their districts, the districts give to the synod, and by assembling a whole lot of other gifts, we're able to do a whole lot of stuff. But we tend to forget that. And as congregations, you know, disengage from the synod and lose not just the feeling, but the reality that this is their synod and they have input into what's happening and they're guiding what the synod is doing, not only for them, but for, you know, 5,800 congregations like them that need the fundamental things the synod was put there to provide, it's, you know, a place to work on doctrinal unity, a place to do the things that are bigger than any congregation can do itself, like provide pastors and do mission work in new areas, to provide hymnals and catechisms and all this kind of stuff that the church doesn't think about all the time but needs. When the congregations feel that they're kind of losing that, or it's just becoming a function out there somewhere like Social Security, they hope it's there when they need another pastor, but it's not really theirs. They're not really actively governing it. We lose the day-to-day interest in supporting these institutions and in keeping them true to their roots. You know, we force our institutions to think about survival rather than service. And that's a dangerous thing to do to the institutions that ultimately the church long-term
mm-hmm.
relies upon. Your congregation will make it for a few weeks without the synod, a few years probably. You know, if you stop getting handbooks, you're probably not going to complain some of you will. I appreciate it. But, you know, eventually there is a reason the congregations formed the synod, built all these wonderful institutions, have invested all this money and time and effort and people's lives into doing this stuff. And that is that the long-term welfare of the church needs it. So my plea for engagement, I guess, as we withdraw from that, as we think, it's not important that I think about sending someone to help govern the Synod. It's not important that I send someone to determine, you know, how our common resources are spent and stewarded. Well, we're just losing our interest in participating in the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a shame,
yeah.
You know, because it is the congregation synod. Mm-hmm. It's not mine or the president's or, you know, even the people that have been elected to all the offices or put in all the positions here at the International Center or wherever they are. It's the congregation synod. And, you know, like we need, like every executive needs good directors that help him be better at what he's doing. Each one of us that's in office needs the whole synod to be engaged and looking at what we're up to and saying, hey, you could have done better there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hey, we're relying on you. We're keeping an eye on you. We want you to do well, but we're going to hold you responsible. That's healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's good.
As we think about this and to really bring this back home to me as the listener back home and what's my next step, there are a number of committees and boards for which we're seeking nominations.
Right.
On those boards and committees, some of them are lay, some of them are commissioned church workers, some of them are ordained. I don't know if there are other categories as well.
Right.
Help me think about this and who I might be nominating. Some commission workers, teachers, DC deaconesses,
sure.
Ordained ministers, pastors, professors. I don't know what all the requirements are.
There's a wide spate of opportunities. And that document that I pointed you to earlier on lcms.org/nominate, the call for nominations document, on that webpage, it's a little cluttered, but there are some kind of, I don't know, yellowish gold boxes, maybe orange boxes. I'm kind of colorblind, so web colors is, I have to look at the little codes and figure out what the numbers mean. But in one of those boxes is that lcms.org, the call for nominations memo, and then what I call the officer board and commission document that lists out exactly what you're asking for. For each position that's up this time, you'll see a list of the folks that are in those seats. The seats that are up for election this time will be marked with the 26, because this is the 26th convention. And those that are filled with someone who is termed out, who's not eligible to do another term, have an asterisk. So you can easily see on there not only what seats are possibly open, but what seats really are open and we really need nominations for, and somebody's got a good shot at getting in there because there's not an incumbent to contend. Of course, not all incumbents continue. So we will take nominations for anything. But you'll see in there, and it will break out by ordained, commissioned, lay. For some of them, like the Commission on Theology and Church Relations, it specifies we need a parish pastor or a parish teacher. And those are quite specific because the CTCR is looking to have voices there from those specific domains. Is what we're producing as a commission, you know, going to play in Cincinnati? Is it gonna work when it's actually taught in confirmation class, when it's taught in a parish classroom? So, and then the other breakdown, I would say, are those offices that are regional, where it doesn't matter where you are as the nominator, but the nominee has to be within and has to serve within the region for that position. If it's on one of the mission boards or some of the seats on the board of directors are regional, they need to be in that area. Again, with the concern that we get the interests and concerns and perspectives of the whole synod rolled in there. For the ordained positions, yeah, we're looking at pastors, professors, whatever positions a person is in. If a person is in an elected position in the synod or district that he's not likely to leave, you can only serve one elected position at a time. And the one that kind of surprises people often is circuit visitors. We've got 600 and some circuit visitors. That's an elected office in the district. So if you're going to be on some other board or, you know, the holy grail of the theology and church relations or seminary something, you're going to have to give up your circuit visitor duty, you know, in order to do. So bylaws 151, 151, 1511 and 1512 go into the gory details. They're also in that document that I talked about. If you're an employee of the Senate or the district, there's some rules there too about what things you can serve on. Although faculty are a little bit freer in their service than others because the Senate said one convention, we're afraid if we don't let faculty be on boards, we'll run out of people to put on boards. That was when we had more boards. The commission workers, teachers, DCEs, DCMs, the whole array, deaconesses, the whole array of commission service. You know, sometimes the teachers, because the classroom is somewhat demanding for at least 9-10 months of the year, you know, it's a little more challenging for them to get away for service. And I think they are still the bulk of our commissioned roster, active commission roster. And we struggle a little bit to ply them away from those roles to serve. Some pretty commonly on a district board of directors, they'll have that input there, which is hugely important. But those that are able to serve, you know, retirees, those that have a little bit more liberty in their work time, absolutely, tee them up.
Very good. Thanks.
Do you have any other questions, Andy? I have one left, but...
All you.
Okay. Last question I always ask is there anything I should have asked that I didn't think to ask? Anything you'd like to say that should be on the, on the record regarding nominations?
Well, my last chance in the deposition here. You know, I think we covered, you know, the ground pretty well. I had prepared for some crazy historical questions just a little bit, you know, like how long have we had a committee for convention nominations, which this actually kind of surprised me.
Really? How long have we had a committee for
CCN? It's bad different CCN names, but it goes back to 1899.
Oh, wow.
You know, so...
That's what, so, I mean, in wow. terms of long-lived boards, that's probably one of the most long-lived. I mean, it's not quite as long as the Lutheran Witness, oldest Lutheran Witness.
Yeah, it's not quite as long as the Board of Directors, but it's up there, you know.
Yeah, wow.
And its composition has changed a little bit over time, and it wasn't until the, at 1989, I think it was, that we got the way of getting it that we currently have. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, it was elected by the previous convention. Mm-hmm. Still had kind of a regional component. But then in the late 80s, we said, okay, let's draw from half the districts at a time and put it together this way. And it was also at that time that it was really opened up for anybody in any pew in the Synod to be able to send a nomination to the thing.
Mm.
And so that I think, is something to celebrate and yeah. something for everybody who's listening to go and check out lcms.org/nominate. We now have an electronic system to handle these, so I can handle the onslaught. if you actually take that up with zeal. So,
thank you, Dr. Sias. Appreciate your time. Thank you, Andy, for joining us also. And thank you to all of you who took the time to listen to the Lutheran Witness podcast and how to nominate people to serve on boards and commissions and committees here in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. As always, we're here to help you learn how to interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective, even when you're nominating.
Thanks to the Lutheran Witness and the Reverend Roy Askins for the opportunity to share this crossover episode with you on the Coffee Hour today. You've been listening to the Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support the Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.